Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. In this episode, we present the final segment of the Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine 75th Anniversary Symposium, which was held at Columbia University on September 30th of this year. In this segment, we feature a reading and talk by Joyce Carol Oates, a long-standing contributor to this magazine.
All right. Throughout the evening, I've made references to my time at Syracuse and the work in the pulp collections there and the various people that I've met. One of the people that I met and got to work with quite closely was Joyce Carol Oates, who's an alumna of Syracuse and whose papers were there. So this event, in many ways, is a sort of homecoming for me. And we're very fortunate to have her here this afternoon to read from some of her stories. She is the winner of the National Book Award, two O. Henry Awards, and the National Medal for the Humanities, among many other honors. One of America's most celebrated writers, she's the author of more than 40 novels and many short stories, most under her own name, but several under her crime writing pseudonyms are Lewin Smith and Lauren Kelly. Her first story for Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine appeared in the October 1992 issue. Over the years, she's contributed more than two dozen more stories to EQMM. They include the Edgar Allan Poe Award-nominated Angel of Wrath, the International Thriller Award-winning Gun Accident, an investigation, and a number of stories that went on to be included in the year's best anthologies, such as Otto Kendler's Best American Mystery Story and the year's best crime mystery stories. So without further ado, I will turn things over to Joyce. You're going to read for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have some time for questions. So, let's welcome Joyce Carol.
Very much. Is this working?
Yes.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I have such a special feeling for Ellery Queen and for Ellery Queen History Magazine. We're beginning with Ellery Queen as the author, or the authors of these remarkable novels. I first discovered them when I was probably 11 or 12 or 13 years old in upstate New York. And I can sort of just imagine and envision the library, the Lockwood Library, and the mystery shelves, and how exciting it was to see Ellery Queen on the spine. And I think I just read every novel. I think I had a sort of voracious appetite for reading, and once I discovered an author that whom I liked, I would just sort of read everything. So it's so special and sort of almost nostalgic to think about Ellery Queen being real people, you know, and having a son, for instance, in the room. The spirit of Ellery Queen. And I really knew so little as a girl about publishing and authors and genre. And now I can see that Ellery Queen represents a certain kind of genre mystery, detective, very intellectual, I guess, and cerebral, and calculating, and sort of like a puzzle. It's not the kind of writing that I actually do, but it was very thrilling to me. I think we're all problem-solving animals in our species, and we love to solve puzzles and problems, whether crossword puzzles or mathematical puzzles, or puzzles of how to construct a story. Many of us have stories, and we have fragments of dreams and narratives that are sort of broken up. So the challenge for the writer is to present the material in structure. Like what is the title, what is the first sentence, first paragraph, what's the first section of the story. If it's a novel, it's an enormous challenge and exhilarating, but it's also stressful. So anyone who writes novels knows this feeling of sort of despair, sort of oscillate between mania and despair and trying to get the structure correct. However, the revision and rewriting and revisioning is very pleasurable. And so I'm going to read a story today, which is very recently published in Ellery Queen, though not the current issue, where I have another story. The story in the current issue is called The Crawl Space, and it really gives me such a shiver because it's set in my former house, which is about 3 minutes away from the house I live in now. And there was a crawl space in that house. If you know what a crawl space is, it's some strange part of a cellar. It's not completely filled in. Sometimes there is a cellar and the crawl space goes out from it. But this particular house didn't really have a cellar. It only had a crawl space. And there were things stored there. And I think repairmen would have to crawl in there and do something. And I think they never came out again. And if you have an imagination, you just imagine how horrible it would be to be in a crawl space. So that story is actually about that dark fantasy that comes true for someone. And I don't think I could read that story. It doesn't have a happy ending. So I guess there are two kinds of mysteries and detective fiction, and the genre is very wide and very rich. And the genre today, or maybe it's always done, it's very regional. We have like Sherlock Holmes is London, we have Raymond Chandler is Los Angeles, we have people writing in Chicago, people writing in New Orleans and in the South. It's become, the genre become very regional and rich with the energies and mysteries and special anguishes, I think, of different parts of the world. And one of the reasons that we read is because of those places. This particular story that I'm going to read is called Big Mama. I don't know if any of you read it. It's pretty awful story, but I'm not sure that I can actually read it. I'll see how far I get. I have a place where I might stop, and then I might keep going to see how. If anyone's left in the room, if no one's here, I'll just stop them. So this will be in my story called The Doll Master and Other Tales of Terror, which is being published by Otto Penzler at the wonderful Mysterious Press. And it's very nice to hear Otto speaking just recently and getting a lot of praise from a rabid fan, such as he attracts. The story is called Big Mama, and I'm reading an edited version. And I might be reading a censored version, I'll see if it happens. Big Mama. At South Valley Middle School, Violet Prentice was new, transfer student. Oh, she hated South Valley. Twice the size of her old school where she had good friends, girls she knows since kindergarten. At the new school, she was tall and invisible. They moved to this new city just 18 miles south of their former city because Wells Fargo, very topical, Wells Fargo had transferred Violet's mother, and she had no choice but to move. Her mother said it was lucky she had been downsized, only relocated in a branch of the bank in a faster growing suburb than the one in which they've been living for as long as Violet could be called. So the story is kind of a story of suburban America, but not a settled suburb. It's more like a fast growing suburb where people don't know one another. And a girl in middle school might well be lonely. Violet's mother was telling her she had heard small children were going missing in the area. Two little girls and a little boy just in the past 6 weeks, and no one had any idea what had happened to them. Local and state police were, quote, investigating all leads, but had not yet made any arrests. Weirdly, there were also missing pets, cats, dogs, and rabbits. In fact, the pets had begun to disappear at least a year ago, and there were many more of these missing than children. As soon as Violet and her mother moved into their new apartment, they'd started seeing these sad posters in stores. Pictures of lost children, lost cats, lost dogs, and lost rabbits with headlines, missing, or have you seen me? Older people like Violet's mother said how strange it was. There didn't seem to be kidnappings in the United States any longer, only just abductions. Violet asked, what's the difference between a kidnapping and an abduction? And her mother said, if a child is kidnapped, the kidnappers contact the parents and ask for a ransom. And the child might be returned. That was how it used to be in the old days. Now, the child is just taken away. And never heard from again, Violet thought, with a shiver. The South Valley Middle School and missing children was spoken of with the same sort of excited shivers. No one actually knew any of the missing children or their families, so it was possible for the Cruder boys to make jokes about the abductions. At a school assembly, the principal, a stout, fussy woman named Mrs. Flanagan, addressed them in a grave voice, warning them to not ever be cajoled into getting into a vehicle with a stranger, and not to walk home from school alone if they could avoid it. If you miss your school bus, report to the office immediately. Do not walk alone on the busy truck roads at any time. Do not walk anywhere after dark alone, or even with a friend. Police had a theory that the abductions were the work of out-of-state truckers who drove their enormous trailer trucks along Ajax Boulevard. This would account for the fact that the children had vanished into thin air. It would be easy to carry captives inside a storage truck, especially if it had a deep freeze, the boys joked. Police claimed there had been witnesses to attempted abductions by truckers on the boulevard, but unfortunately, witnesses hadn't been able to see the truck licenses, only to notice by their color that the licenses had been out of state. So far, there had been several children missing, eight cats, five dogs, a dozen or more pet rabbits. Each had left behind a bereft family, including stricken children. Talking about the disappearances, Rita May, a new friend of Violet, said with a shudder, "Wonder where they all are. Seems like the poor things would all be in the same place." "Some kind of heaven, you think?" Violet said. Rita May giggled. "Or hell." Unlike the boring residential neighborhood in which Violet lived in her new home, the Clovises lived in what Mr. Clovis called a rural retreat. This is a family Violet has been befriended by a girl in her class, whose name is Rita May Clovis. Their house was a sprawling old farmhouse at the edge of town in an open field that had once been a pasture. Behind the farmhouse were decaying outbuildings. Remains of a decaying apple orchard, and at the rear of the property, a straggling forest of deciduous trees. The neighboring house wasn't even visible. "Lots of privacy for my brood," Mr. Clovis said with a wink. Rita May told Violet that she thought her father had inherited the property somehow, and that it had once been much larger. Acres and acres, now there's just 2 acres. Rita May did not seem to recall if her mother had ever lived in the house or if she disappeared before Mr. Clovis moved in. Violet thought it was cool to live in such a big, sprawling old house where you could find an actual room to be alone if you wanted to. Most of the upstairs rooms were empty of furnishings, cobwebs everywhere, husks of dead insects underfoot, and a pervasive smell of grime, but she much preferred the Clovis house to the cramped two-bedroom apartment at Bailey Garden Apartments. There, Violet was often alone and lonely. And even when her mother was home, Violet felt lonely. Close behind the farmhouse were rows of small, nasty-looking cages with wire mesh, which Rita May said were rabbit hutches. And all the less than a dozen of these, Violet wasn't sure if there were rabbits in the enclosures or if the enclosures were empty. Where horribly, there were remains of rabbits inside that had never been cleared away. "It's okay, Violet," Rita May said, seeing Violet's nose pointing at the smell. "You don't have to clean them. You're not family yet." The downstairs of the Clovis house smelled of scorched and spilled food, a not unpleasant aroma as of overripe fruit. The kitchen was pleasantly hot, even steamy. Rita May's older sister was preparing supper, cooking spaghetti. Mr. Clovis kept popping into the kitchen to taste the sauce. "I like my Italian sauce hot and spicy, don't you, Violet?" What was this meat? Violet wanted not to eat meat. She would like to be a vegetarian, but it was so hard to resist. The mouth watered at the smell. Of course, Violet was invited to stay for dinner. And she calls her mother and says she can't come home. And she feels very warm and welcome at the house. And that day, Violet saw Rita Mae whispering with her old, the oldest sister who's been making dinner, and her brother. And there was Mr. Clovis smiling in her direction. Rita Mae said to them in a voice loud enough for Brad over here, "Hey, it's cool. Violet's cool." What was it? Violet felt anxious, wondering what they were saying. Were they talking about her? "Would you like to meet Big Mama, Violet, before we sit down for supper?" Violet smiled uncertainly. She glanced at Rita Mae, who said, "Sure she would, Dad." Mr. Clovis took Violet's hand in his warm, careless hand and led her along a corridor into the rear of the house. She'd never been in this part of the house before. Her nostrils began to pinch with a new, strange smell. Mr. Clovis said, "It's a little surprise. We have a special pet. We don't show just anyone. Big Mama is her name." "What kind of pet?" Violet's heart beat quickly. "Oh, not your ordinary pet." Out of his pocket, Mr. Clovis took a key to unlock an unusually heavy door that looked as if it were reinforced with steel. When he led Violet into the room beyond, Rita Mae and the others followed close behind, and the door was shut behind them. "Big Mama, look who's here. Violet, our friend." At first, Violet couldn't make out what the thing, the creature, was on the other side of a glass barrier. But was it a snake? A huge snake? The largest snake she'd ever seen, even in photographs, lay languid and unmoving on the floor inside an enclosure like a large aquarium, only about 10 feet away on the other side of the glass. Strange words came to her like stuttering. Boar, Victor, or Stricter. The immense snake was thick as a big man's body, with a scaly, glittering skin, splashed in diamond shapes, cloudy and brown like a rotten banana. The air in the windowless room was oppressively humid like a jungle. There was a smell as of rotted fruit and a sharper, saltier smell. Violet's heart was pounding so violently she almost fainted. "Oh, what is it? A snake?" "Python. Reticulated python." Proudly, the Clovises told Violet of Big Mama, who was some age beyond 10 and weighed more than 300 pounds. "That's just our estimate. Nobody's ever weighed her. Big Mama was as long as 20 feet when she stretched out straight, which she rarely did. Mostly, Big Mama lay in coils." Rita Mae said excitedly, "I knew you'd like her, Violet. We all think she is way cool. Daddy brought her from a carnival when we lived in Florida. The carnival was disbanding, so Daddy got her cheap. She wasn't so big then, I guess. A python is way, way bigger than a boa constrictor. She got her name Big Mama by just growing." One of the Clovises nudged Violet in the back of the small of her back to push her forward for a better look at the python. Languidly, the snake's eyes opened as if Violet, stepping forward, had stepped into the snake's vision. The head was so large. Violet stared at the hideous, huge snake that was staring back calmly at her. It was unnerving, that snake had such large eyes, intelligent and alert eyes they seemed, the size of oranges, tawny in color, with dark slits for pupils. And did the snake have eyelashes? Violet trembled to see. She did. Then Violet saw the snake's cylindrical body was distended about 5 feet from the head. Something fairly large had been swallowed whole. The Clovises were eager to speak of Big Mama, in whom they clearly took much pride. "A Big Mama was fed a few days ago. She doesn't eat often, just eats a whole lot. Then she rests." "Oh, Big Mama sleeps a lot, you think. But see, she's not actually sleeping. She's watching. Big Mama doesn't have teeth like we do to grind up food. She swallows her food whole. She catches her food in her coils and squeezes so it's paralyzed. But she doesn't care for dead food. She likes live. Her mouth stretches open, sort of unhinges. You wouldn't believe how wide, so she can swallow her food. It's awesome. It only looks like she's sleeping, but if you were to go inside, she'd wake up fast." The Clovises laughed. The prospect of venturing inside the glass enclosure made Violet feel panic. There was a buzzing in Violet's head. She had the difficulty hearing the Clovises. She saw Mr. Clovis glancing at her with his warm brown eyes and friendly smile, and Rita Mae to see how she was taking Big Mama. Was it a test to see if Violet was one of them or a coward? Violet asked him, "What do you feed her?" "Rabbits, lots of rabbits. Sometimes mice. Lots and lots of mousies. Lots of rabbits." Violet said, "That doesn't look like the size of a rabbit." Well, it could be a jackrabbit. They're real big. Clovis has laughed excited. Violet saw Emil, the brother, clenching and unclenching his fists. His face shone with pride. Now Violet noticed that there were cages along the wall of the room the size of the outdoor rabbit hutches. Fortunately, they were all empty. In a corner, there was an axe, and on the floor, scattered pages of newspapers soaked with dark stains. Where do you get the rabbits? Violet was trying not to stammer. Where do we get the rabbits, Dad? Emil asked as if he couldn't recall. Pet supply store, son, out Ajax Boulevard. Do you think Big Mom is beautiful, Violet? Rita May's breath was warm against Violet's cheek. Yes, Big Mom is beautiful. Violet spoke in such a halting voice, Oliver closed his laugh. It was like teasing, she knew. Did that mean that they liked her if they teased her? She thought so. Mr. Clovis trailed his hand lightly against the nape of Violet's neck. Violet shivered, but did not shrink away. Next time we feed Big Mom, you can help Violet. Would you like that? Hesitantly, Violet nodded. Yes. So I'm going to stop at the So I'm happy to answer any questions that people might have, except how the story ends. The story ends, you have to buy Oliver's book, which is coming out in 2017.
Any questions about herpetology or parodying those?
Any questions of any kind? Except politics.
So this is a question for Joyce and Janet both, because you've obviously have been working together a number of years on a number of stories. And I was just curious from each of your vantage point, what it's like to work together and what it's like to work together after all this time.
Well, I can say it's a pleasure to work with Janet. Her responses are so warm and kind of intimate and personal. And sometimes there might be little sentences or a few about some particular part of the story that Janet has responded to. So it's very special, and has been going on for a while, so I feel like Janet's like a sister, cousin, in upstate New York.
Well, I have to say, I've been meaning to tell voices for a long time. When I first came to the magazine in 1991, one of the first things I wanted to do was to invite Joyce to write the magazine, because I had actually been the reader of your first book under pseudonym, The Literary Guild. So I knew that you were doing that kind of fiction, and I thought, I'll just call the agent, I'll never get a reply, and the agent will just brush me off. But I called the agent, and the agent said, oh, just call them, use your phone number. And I remember calling you that day, and you picking up the phone, and I asked you to be on that cover.
That was fantastic.
And you said, just come out to after my house, and we'll take care of it there. And you allowed an entire film crew to come out to your house, disrupt your day, spend the afternoon with us, and I was overwhelmed by the kindness of that.
Mm-hmm. It was very pleasurable. It's very, very special to be on the cover. And it was my first publication in Ellery Queen. It was a short novella. A short novella, and I don't think I've ever published a pseudonym. It's always been my own.
Well, I'm in the magazine, yes.
Yeah. But I think that the kind of writing that I do is not puzzle mysteries, and often don't have happy endings. As I understand the genre, I mean, I'm obviously in the presence of people who really know a lot about the genre. The genre does work for a resolution in the last chapter or last pages, I believe, and so that the mysteries are cleared up. Is that the case with the Ellery Queen novels, their south? Well, it's more of a postmodernist thing, or ironic, or bitterly dark, or whatever, or realistic, or whatever. Look, mysteries are often not south, you know. This girl may just disappear, and nobody's going to ever know where she went, including her mother. And that mystery will never be solved, and maybe all the missing children and missing pets. Yeah, that would be solved, and that's the way life is often. So I think we come to art, to certain kinds of genre work, because it does provide the endings that may not be happy endings, but they're resolutions, and they make us think that the world is coherent and somehow reasonable and plausible and livable, as the world sometimes does not seem.
Yes.
So clearly you've given a lot of thought to questions of genre. To what extent are questions like those present in your mind when you're working on a particular story?
Well, it's a good question. I think of genre the way a poet might think of a sonnet. It's a form. I wouldn't say it was a formula. It's more like a form. And within that form, you can do interesting things. There are different kinds of sonnets. There's a Petrarchan sonnet. People who write in the 20th century have done experimental things with sonnets so that they're actually longer or shorter, or the rhymes are different. So if I work with a genre work, like my mysteries of A Winter Term are three classic mysteries based on classic American mysteries. And each one of them allows the reader to know who's the villain. But in the novel itself, the townspeople don't know. In other words, it's a way of writing that I found was satisfactory for what I was trying to do. That people get away with murder in real life, but in reading about it, the reader maybe knows a little more than the people know. Then another thing about genre is that it's a kind of contract between the reader and the writer, and maybe the publisher. The contract is implicit. That in a certain kind of genre work, it will be explained in the final chapter or the final pages. And if you just rip that off, you have something like Thomas Mann or Otto was talking about, he was being made to read T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, and Dostoevsky, and so forth at University of Michigan. And that kind of writing does not appeal to everybody. So in fact, Dostoevsky was a 19th century writer. He did sort of sour things like Dickens and other Victorian writers, so everything was kind of sour at the end. But when you come to the 20th century, there isn't really that implicit contract between a literary writer and a reader. The idea is that each literary work of art is unique. It doesn't have a formula. And that's why many people don't like it and don't read it, I'm afraid. It makes people uneasy and the ground is usually shifting. So if I work with genre, I bring to my genre work the same principles that most genre readers would expect, that things are explained in the fact at the end, but there is not necessarily justice. Like my stories in Ebony Queen, there's no mystery about the ending. They're explained at the end, but there isn't any justice. So with the Ellery Queen books, which I don't remember, with any kind of detective fiction, you solve the crime, and the reader knows who did it. Now the next step in the real world is to get a conviction, get an indictment, a conviction, a trial, a conviction, and a sentencing. And all along the line there, as we know, like in the O.J. Simpson case, many, many things go wrong. So that ending of genre where the murder is apprehended, for some people, it's not a realistic ending because we don't know whether the justice will ensue from that. So I think about all these things and I find it very engaging and exciting.
Other questions? All right, I guess we're keeping the schedule then. So thank you, Joyce. That was. So we have a few more remarks coming up here, and I don't remember the exact order of operations, so let me consult my notes. I'm actually thinking maybe we should end with Jenny, since you'll be heading out to see the exhibition. So I think that would mean that Peter Cantor is up, the publisher of EQMM, and the president and publisher of Penny Publications, the parent company, along with its sister short story magazines, Alfred Hitchcock's History Magazine, Asimov's Science Fiction, and Analog Science Fiction. In fact, Peter,
here you are.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I can unmute that.
Oh, yeah, I'm not here.
So it's a real pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me. Film Magazines is really honored to publish Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, and we're proud to take part in such a long tradition. We're especially pleased to be associated with our talented authors and artists, and our engaged readers and friends. And you're so well represented in this room, so I take great pleasure in standing here. We couldn't have made it to 75 years without you. And I hope when we go up to the reception, there might be some wine or water, and we can toast our good fortune in having Janet Hutchins as our editor, and we can toast our next 75 years. So thank you very much.
Well, I think I'll just hand the mic to Janet, since she needs no introduction.
Thank you, Sean. So much of what I had intended to say today has already been said by other people, so it's probably going to be a little bit repetitive. I'll try to cut some of it, and Daphne will probably object to it. We've heard a lot today about LRP's Mystery Magazine's history and its influence. Before we close, I'd like to say just a few words about why I think the magazine remains relevant to the needs and the interests of today's readers. Often people ask who don't know the magazine, ask me to describe it in a few words. And that's always very difficult, because looked at in one way, EQMM is just a very small outpost in a vast publishing universe. We publish almost exclusively short stories, and those short stories belong, at least nominally, only to the mystery category. But EQMM, as we've heard today, is so much more than that. And one thing that people don't realize, I think, is when Fred and I started the magazine, and he had a new concept, as we've heard today, he was going to bring together between the covers of a single magazine, for the first time, stories of widely different types, everything from what he called realistic hard figures in hard-boiled school, to stories in the tradition of Britain's golden age of the mystery, to stories that absolutely nobody had ever considered mystery or crime stories before, and sometimes often they were by mainstream or literary writers. This was a big risk. I think people from a commercial, looking at from a commercial perspective, this was a big risk. It was an experiment as well. We didn't know if it was going to succeed. And I think that it wouldn't have succeeded if there hadn't been enough people out there in the reading public who didn't have very fixed tastes and interests, you know, that were open to many different styles of fiction. Danny famously said that the only criterion for inclusion in his new magazine would be quality. Now, obviously, there's a bit of hyperbole in that, because we know that he had some idea of what was going to fall within the magazine's parameters. What he had in mind, I think, was that almost all fiction in some way touches on the darker motives to human behavior. And it's in those darker motives that we find the roots of crime. And so the mystery is just naturally the widest of all the genres of fiction. I think he saw that and he wanted the magazine to reflect it. Well, he was very successful in his experiment, probably more so, I think, than even he would have expected. The first issue sold over 90,000 copies. And I really wonder if someone tried to start a fiction magazine like EQMM with the same broad perspective today, whether it would be as easily launched or as successful. I think the publishing environment now is very different. It's not really conducive to a broad approach. If you go up on Amazon, for instance, there it goes. I'll try to cut this shorter, but if you go up and buy a book on Amazon, for example, you'll be prompted under that banner, people who bought this book also bought these other titles, to try selections very similar to your own taste, to what people like you are buying. They're selecting for the common denominator. They're not selecting for the more unusual choices that people might have made. And I think that's fine. We all benefit from that sometimes. But there need to be places where people can find things that are off their beaten path. And EQMM in its early years especially was that kind of place. It was a vehicle where people could expand their reading horizons just because of the vast differences in the kind of material that it published. The situation is very different today, though. EQMM was available then on virtually every newsstand in the United States, and it was available in many other places of the world as well. I had an author who used to find it as a child in Baghdad. So it was everywhere. The newsstand now, the US newsstand now, it has over 7,000 titles competing for space. It's a very crowded newsstand. The virtual newsstand is crowded as well. And I think that if somebody tried to start a new magazine of this sort now, they'd have a much harder time than we did back 75 years ago.
But we shouldn't confuse the fact that it would be harder to market such a magazine now and carve out a readership with there not being a need for a publication such as ours anymore. I think that there's still a great need for this type of publication. For one thing, some of the battles that Fred Danet was fighting in the 1940s, particularly against the narrow classification of fiction and against the dismissal of the mystery, haven't entirely been won. I mean, obviously the situation has changed a lot, and we have a lot more openness towards crossing of genres, and the mystery is considered much more respectful today. But when I travel to conventions and to conferences, I still come across people who tell me they wouldn't ever venture into the territory of a hard-boiled mystery. And I come across others who just wouldn't be caught dead with what's called a cozy mystery. I mean, those attitudes do still exist. And it's a shame that they do, because so much has changed in terms of the content of fiction within the genre these days. It used to be thought that the cozy mystery was so artificial that readers who didn't like realistic fiction just really wouldn't be interested in it. But over the years, the cozy itself has become more realistic. There's been a combining of traditional classical plots with more realistic depictions of society. Think of the traditional mysteries of P.D. James, for example. So I think that one of the main things that distinguishes those two subgenres now is mainly that they depict different segments of society. Where with the cozy mystery depicting a segment of society in which violence is an anomaly, and the hard-boiled mystery depicting a segment of society in which crime is a fact of everyday life. And I think most readers want to read about all aspects of our world. They don't want to read about one part of it or the other. And our magazine survives because there are readers who want to have a very wide view of what they want to read. I also think that it's through fiction that fiction is one of the best tools we have from which to see the world from different perspectives. And that the wider our reading of fiction is, the more likely we are to have empathy for people who aren't like ourselves. And I would say that unconsciously that influences me as editor of UPMM. But it's one of those things that is sort of way in the background, because actually, at the bottom, we're a commercial enterprise. If we're going to survive, the only way we can survive is by entertaining readers. And the only thing about that is that we seek to entertain readers by giving them a wide variety of perspectives, a wide variety of styles and types of mystery. We think that's how to entertain readers. And recently I found a letter from Manfred B. Lee to Fred Danet, in which he talked about this. I was very surprised when I read this. It was a letter written back in the 1940s. And in it, Manny said, explains why he thinks Fred's formula, his concept of the magazine, is the right one. He says, there's nothing so deadly in a magazine as sameness. That's why I can't read most slick magazines. The identical slant is just too monotonous. I think most people of intelligence feel the same way. And I think most people who read EQMM regularly are people of intelligence. Well, Manny goes on to say that he thinks Fred has found good concept. By combining stories of widely different types, he's going to hold the readership. EQMM was the first magazine in our field to do that. We've been followed by others, similar magazines, and actually we have a sister magazine, as you've heard of today, and you all know anyway, Albert Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, that has also survived and thrived for 60 years now. It's their 60th anniversary this year. So congratulations. Magazines have made it through so many changes in our world and our society. I think we can say they've endured through a combination of a strong concept, it was a strong original concept that launched EQMM and subsequent magazines like it, and high editorial standards. But a magazine actually needs more than that if it's going to succeed. I think a magazine will thrive only if a committed community of readers and writers grows up around it. A community that interacts with the editors and influences the magazine in a variety of ways. Because of the diversity of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's content, the community that's grown up around the magazine is a very diverse one. It consists of people of different economic, social, and ethnic backgrounds. It consists of people with different levels of formal education. consists of people from everywhere across the map and even in many different countries. And it includes people of many different sorts of worldviews and ideas. I think that's a pretty remarkable thing if you stop to think about it, especially in today's world when we all seem to be more and more divided from one another in various ways. And I think it's something that's worth celebrating, that we can all come together in this community just for our love of the Good Mystery Story. And I hope we can carry that forward far into the future. Lots of thanks to everybody tonight. First of all, thank all of you for being here with us to celebrate this anniversary. A particular thanks to our panel participants and moderators, to Joyce for her wonderful reading, to Sean Pemby and Jennifer Belie for the exhibition and the symposium, to Raida, our videographer, to our absolutely wonderful senior assistant editor, Jackie Sherbo, who did so much to make all these anniversary events possible, and to our publisher, Peter Cantor, and our associate publisher, Chris Bailey, for their support over these many, many years. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Janet. So now we actually will have time, and there will be wine and water and more. So, but first, I'd like to introduce you to Jenny Lee, who curated the exhibition that you'll see. She wears many hats in the Rare Book Library. She's the curator for performing arts, also our exhibitions coordinator. So we also have an exhibition celebrating the centennial of the Pulitzer Prize on display in our main gallery. She helps to acquire materials in the history of science. You probably know something about reticulated pythons. So she does just about everything for us. And so I'll turn things over to Jenny, and then we'll head upstairs. So Jenny.
Well, just a word or two about this wonderful opportunity to put together an exhibition. It is in our Chang Octagon space, a lovely chapel-like space. You will see an essay by Eleanor Sullivan that is edited by Frederick Dene, which is fascinating to see how he then rewrote some of the words. But first and foremost, I want to thank Richard and his brother for having given the archive that is here. It is about 200 boxes. There are 101 boxes of the Fred Dene papers and 90-something boxes of the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine archive in the Dene years. And it is just, as you will see, it is priceless. So I thank you.
Thank you all again, and thanks to our panelists. It was a wonderful afternoon. Let's have some wine. Take the elevators just out here, the east elevators, to the 6th floor, and you can't miss the Rare Book Main Manuscript Library doors. So as soon as you step off the elevators.
Thank you.
This podcast was recorded and edited by Che Ryback, and it is presented with the permission of the participants. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.